Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
Rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to Cap Chats. Today we are going to talk about United States versus Gene Williams. This case was decided back in May, but we're getting caught up. I am joined today by the brilliant Major James Barrett. Major Barrett, have we done a podcast together?
I think this is the first time that you and I have been able to do a podcast together, yes.
Well, there's a first and a last time for everything, so let's get started. Fair warning, there are not a ton of takeaways for the trial or trial defense counsel practitioners out in the field on this one. Today's episode will be predominantly an academic one, most relevant to our appellate practitioners, and I'll be honest with you, that's a gloss that I'm putting over the number of rabbit holes that we have gone down this morning with this case.
But I think if you stick with us, you're going to find that potentially the CAF buried the lead in this case, and there could be some potentially exciting things to come in the appellate world.
All right. So first, let's talk about sort of the complicated procedural history of this case. In 2013, Gene Williams was convicted of rape, sodomy, and assault consummated by a battery of two victims, T.W. and S.W. He was sentenced to a dishonorable discharge, confinement for 20 years, forfeiture of all pay and allowances, and a reduction to E1. ACCA affirmed the findings and sentence of that first case. And the first time this case was in front of CAF, it considered whether the military judge abused his discretion by providing a propensity instruction. And in accordance with the decision in United States versus Hills, CAF remanded the issue back to the lower court. The lower court again affirmed the findings and sentence, and it went to CAF a second time. CAF at that point found a Hills violation and set aside the findings of guilt relating to both TW and SW. CAF at that point authorized a rehearing. And then in 2019, so 6 years later, Williams was tried at a combined rehearing. The charges at that rehearing consisted of three specifications of forcible sodomy of SW, so one of the original victims, and then new charges relating to a new victim, EZ.
And that's going to become important later on for us, is that these are new charges and original charges.
Yeah. And the TW victim, those charges, those specifications and charges were dismissed by the government. So at this rehearing, Williams was found guilty of three specifications relating to SW and one specification relating to EZ. He was sentenced to a dishonorable discharge, confinement for 35 years, forfeiture of all pay and allowances, and reduction to E1.
And that's going to be important because when this goes up on appeal for the second time, I guess third time to ACCA, maybe, if you're counting, they talk about the statute of limitations that has to deal with the allegations contained in the new charges for the second rehearing made by EZ. And in that case, ACCA found that those charges were actually barred by the statute of limitations. They cited United States versus McPherson for that. That's 81 MJ 372. And not to go down on a rabbit hole this early on, but I think, you know, we talked about maybe not having anything for the practitioner in this case, but this case you can still learn a ton from.
Absolutely.
McPherson is not something to be overlooked. It's a complicated case that has to do with a gap in the statute of limitations that Congress failed to fill when they reworked the statute of limitations several years ago, now probably closer to a decade. But it's interesting that under RCM 907B2, statute of limitations can be waived. So an accused can come in and say, I know statute of limitations bars this, but I still want to plead guilty or I still want to proceed. That's okay. But what makes that interesting is under the rules, if the accused appears to be not aware that they can assert the statute of limitations, the military judge shall inform the accused of that right. And so just a good reminder for the field is these cases are still bouncing around out there with these longer dates 2016, 2017, 2018, 15, 14. They're still bouncing around out there. So this is not just a blanket hand wave to say like, hey, statute of limitations, good to go. No, it's still something for everybody to reorient themselves to and actually give their charges and specs a proper analysis.
And I think that's a great point. And to that point, you know, this seems like kind of a one-off case, but you see things, you see this instance in Hills, kind of with McPherson. I think probably we're going to see a little bit of it in Mendoza, where we're seeing cases that are going to come back and we're going to have to deal with older versions
yes.
of the rules, and that rehearings are going to be happening. And so these sort of complicated gray area cases where maybe there's new charges or maybe we're operating under a different set of rules, this is not going to be completely... this is not going to be completely foreign to practitioners.
Yes, and particularly with the way the speed and volume of changes we're seeing in the UCMJ itself. I mean, look at when U.S. versus Williams was first tried. Hills, good law. 413 allowed you to propensity for charged offenses. Goes up, that's no longer good law. Okay, well, now the statute of limitations, somebody, McPherson comes out, then that bars some of the offenses that he was convicted of. And so it's an ever-evolving landscape. And if you're a practitioner out there and you're not keeping up with the tide, you could find yourself missing actually a really big issue. So this case, while only 10 pages and seems simple on its face, it is jam-packed full of little lessons that everybody can learn.
Yes. So on appeal of the rehearing, of the 2019 rehearing, as Major Barra said, the specifications relating to EZ were time-barred, and so they were dismissed. And so the lower court reassessed, so the lower court is ACCA in this case, the lower court reassessed Williams's sentence pursuant to United States versus Winkleman, and affirmed only 19 years of confinement. Everything else, the DD, the forfeiture, the reduction to the grade of E1, all of that stayed the same. And that brings us to what is the granted issue in this case, which is whether the Army Court of Criminal Appeals abused its discretion in reassessing appellant's sentence. So, Major Barrett, before we talk about this case specifically, let's go down one of the biggest rabbit holes we went down, which is Winkleman dead?
Great question. So if you pull the thread back on Winkleman, Winkleman gives you four factors for the Army Court to go ahead and reassess the sentence.
Right.
If you look at the end of those four things that Winkleman cites, there is not a citation. So it appears that it is the court coming up with guidance for ACCA to, or the lower CCAs, to go ahead and reassess a sentence. The other interesting thing is...
Sorry, before you... So what authority do appellate courts have to reassess the sentence at all? Like, why do they need this framework?
So they need this framework because if you looked at Article 66 prior to the version we have now, it included very specific language about affirming only what is incorrect in law and fact. And if you really pull the thread back on Winkleman, it goes all the way back to a Supreme Court case, I believe in 1957. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Rianne. But all the way back in 1957, and they basically hold that a military board can go ahead and reassess the sentence based upon the powers granted to them all the way back within the current, that version of Article 66 at the time. And if you look at Judge Ryan's concurrence in Winkleman, she says that this basically the sentence reassessment is based upon Article 66 as well. And all this language that's out there, all the reasoning that, hey, these are aggregate sentences, these are not unitary, not segmented sentencing, all of that is now gone with the current system. And so right now with sentencing, we have this weird hybrid of some of it's segmented and some of it is unitary. So segmented is your sentencing, your confinement and your fines. Unitary is everything else. It's hard labor, restriction, reprimand, punitive discharge, forfeitures, reduction. All of that is unitarily applied. And so some of the reasoning that Winkleman is based on and some of the reasoning that we use to reassess sentences now is kind of eroded a little bit. And so I'm curious to see what type of challenges are being made at the appellate level and then how this kind of works its way through the system, because it brings up a lot of interesting questions.
And one of the things that I found interesting in Taylor is that part of the rationale for boards of review at the time to reassess a sentence is because panels were giving sentences. And the Supreme Court in Taylor said the court martial performs more like those of a jury than a court. It is composed of laymen. And so basically, because at the time a panel could sentence, that was part of the reason that a board of review comprised of attorneys could reassess a sentence. But the question, which echoes what your question was, that now that judges are doing sentencing, does that rationale hold? I mean, I don't know if there's good enough reason to overturn it necessarily, but the sort of foundation on which we have reassessed, that the appellate courts have reassessed a sentence, and the rationale behind that is eroded with all of the new rules.
The factual sufficiency powers of ACCA have changed. The sentence review authority or criteria for ACCA has changed. We're dealing with essentially, at its heart, we're dealing with plainly unreasonable now, not what should be approved and correct in law and fact, which is, I think, going to be a interesting question that will eventually be addressed about how we go ahead and do sentence reassessments or what that standard is. Now, in this case, when I said the CAF buried the lead, is CAF essentially able to sidestep all these issues because of the date of the original sentence that was adjudged.
Right.
And I guess that's kind of a good segue into kind of bring us back into the cases. Part of the issue in this case was what information that ACCA reviewed when doing the sentence reassessment. And so kind of have to go back in time a little bit. At the time of the original sentence, Article 63 of the UCMJ existed in a state that said, hey, and it's still the same for today. We can talk about the little changes later. But it existed in a state today and then that basically said, if you're tried on a rehearing, your sentence is going to be capped at what that original sentence was. And that's why it was important at the beginning that we were talking about, hey, all these original charges are still there. And because all the original charges are still there that he was convicted of, there's no additional charges. The CAF acknowledged that the CCA rightfully said, hey, because all these original charges existed, we're capped at that original 20. Because remember, Williams went from 20, 35, and now back to 20, now back to 19. And the reason why they had to start at 20 was because that was what the original sentence was. And you see that under Article 63 of the UCMJ, the authority, and then it's implemented under RCM 810D. As I'm fond of saying, for every statute, there's an RCM for that, and for every RCM, there's a statute for that. Just a quick note on the, you know, this case being jam-packed with things to learn. RCM 810 about his rehearings and sentencing kind of changed. And you see the change in the 2019 manual. In the 2012 manual and the 2016 manual, it talked about if you changed your plea, even if there was a plea agreement, your sentence was capped at what was lawfully adjudged at your old court-martial. And lawfully adjudged words are important because under those rules, post-trial rules and convening authority powers, lawfully adjudged was what the judge gave you, but it wasn't what your sentence was until the convening authority approved that sentence. Now, there's limitations on what the convening authority could approve or what they had to approve or disapprove, but that was irregardless of what was adjudged. And that was in the, for some of you more diehard listeners out there that have been around for a while, you got the quantums portions of sentences that were out there. So, for example, under the old rules, if I pled guilty and the judge gave me 50 days, but the quantum said the convening authority will only approve 20 days, if I went back on a rehearing and changed my plea, it's my interpretation of the rules that you would have been still capped at that 50 days. That little quirk has now been changed, partially because the convening authority is no longer approving the sentence. The convening authority is either taking action or no action. And the judge's sentence is going to be what is being implemented by the entry of judgment, not what under the old system was initial action. Very dense stuff. Really nerded out hard. Rianne, are you okay? You awake still?
Yeah, I am.
But that's something that you could learn from this case as well if you just pull back the rabbit hole. And so I'd encourage actually in the field out there, if you read one of these cases and you're like, oh, this is pretty cut and dry, that may be fine and dandy for the actual issue that was decided. But you can learn so much if you just take an hour 15 and really pull the thread on some of these quirky issues out there. You can actually start to build that Rolodex, that foundation of knowledge out there. So getting back to this case, the CAF rightfully acknowledges that they were capped at the 20 years based upon the 860 Article 63 and RCMA 10 that was in play at the time. Then they talk about the Winkleman factors. And one of the things that the CCA did that CAF took issue with was they went ahead and considered the prior rape charge that was convicted and then dismissed prior to the second rehearing. And they said that the only thing that was relevant to the sentence rehearing was what happened at the site of the error. And the site of the error was that EZ's charges were statute of limitations barred. And so that should be the only thing that they considered. And so CAF actually goes back and says, to use their language, we do not sanction the lower court's Winkleman analysis for factors 3 and 4 that use the first court martial's rape offense in its analysis. But they go ahead and acknowledge that there was no miscarriage of justice or an abuse of discretion by the CCA at the time. So they go ahead and affirm. Another interesting thing that they do in a footnote is they only affirm a sentence that includes for a BCD, because in the original court-martial, he received a BCD and the 20 years confinement. In the second court-martial, he received a dishonorable discharge and 35 years in confinement. And so when they did the sentence reassessment and found that the cap of 20 years applied, it just didn't apply to just the confinement. It applied to the sentence as a whole. So that is a little bit of a quirk and something that everybody kind of overlooked from the trial level to the appellate court level that wasn't caught until we got all the way up to CAF.
Well, and that brings us back a little bit full circle to the discussion about whether or not Winkleman is dead, because now we have segmented sentencing instead of unitary sentencing. And one of the things that you and I talked about as we were preparing was the fact that what is segmented is the confinement. So spec one is worth 2 years, spec two is worth 3 years, spec three is worth 60 days, whatever. The BCD, all those things you talked about are unitary. And so the question likely will be for the appellate courts is, okay, if we remove this charge, okay, yeah, 60 days comes off the appellant's sentence, but then what does that do to the discharge? What does that do to the forfeitures? What does that do to the things that are still unitary?
I mean, if I gave you somebody with 5 specs of domestic violence for shoving, and each spec got 45 days confinement, and then I gave you a BCD on top of it, and all of those specs ran concurrently, so only 45 days confinement. If I got rid of 4 of those specifications, under some current schools of thought, well, that just still leaves me with 45 days of confinement.
Mm-hmm.
But if I told you I had 1 spec of DV for a push and I gave you 45 days confinement for it, where does that leave me with the BCD? Where does that leave me mm-hmm. with the reduction? How do I go ahead and do that analysis? And then how do I go ahead and do that analysis with the current statutory landscape that the CCAs and now the CAF are dealing with? It's going to be interesting that a lot of the foundational underpinnings that some of these cases are built upon statutory language that no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
And so are we as practitioners, are we going to be trying to shoehorn all of this in and be like, well, this is only a minor change, so we're going to do this? Or is this going to be just a brand new line of cases? And if it's a brand new line of cases, then the JACOR, you guys, and everyone out there, you're very smart. You have a tremendous amount of talent. Get creative. Show us what you can do.
Well, and to your point about the language that no longer exists, that's why as we were preparing for this, you know, spending the hour and a half pulling on threads and going down rabbit holes, understanding what the rationale is for these decisions. What was the rationale in Taylor? What about the unique nature of the military justice system has caused these courts to make these decisions? And so I think that's going to be incredibly important, is understanding Why? Like, not only what statutory language the courts were relying on, but then why? Like, what about our system and the way that it functions and the fact that it has to function in a special society?
Yeah.
And how that impacts and how that's going to feed into whether or not, you know, Winkleman continues to exist, those kinds of things.
And you see it also, not to bring it back to my my humble portfolio for post-trial.
Oh, no. You told me you found something in post-trial. But I was hoping to avoid it.
Well, it was the approve and disapprove thing. But you also see it with how we do the Barker-Wingo analysis and the Marino factors for determining post-trial delay. Those are all based upon rules and a system that ostensibly no longer exists. And so what do we do with those? Again, on its face, a lot of practitioners open up this case, 10 pages, oh, they didn't abuse their discretion, 19 years, guy did a bunch of bad stuff, good to go, move on. But when actually pulling back the thread in this case, I looked at the 2008 MCM, the 2012 MCM, 2016 MCM, 2019 MCM, 2024 MCM. You've got, what is the actual site for the Taylor case over there?
The actual site for the Taylor case is 353 U.S. 569.
And that's from 1957 Supreme mm-hmm. Court case. And we've read Winkleman and a bunch of other cases. Just apply yourselves for an hour or so and look at all of this that we've learned in the UCMJ world that has kind of opened up to you.
Yeah. And so the last question that I don't know that we've touched on, and I don't know that we have an answer to. I think we've kind of answered the Winkleman question. But the question that we don't have an answer to is, how is all of this affected by the sentencing parameters? Because, I mean, now we want uniform sentencing. We want sentences to be consistent across the force, across jurisdictions. And so how, if at all, do those sentencing parameters impact the review by the appellate courts?
I've got a really easy answer for you that's going to knock your socks off. No idea.
Okay. Well, thanks for that buildup. That's
no, I mean, it all depends upon how you want to do the sentence reassessment, because you've got the parameters out there, and if the sentence is within the parameter, Article 66 gives you two standards of review. For the sentence as a whole, it's plainly unreasonable. If I go above the parameter, then I'm back into this inappropriately severe analysis. So I do two analyses. If it's above the parameter, is it inappropriately severe? If it's not, then I go to the sentence as a whole, and do I say that it's plainly unreasonable? And when we start talking about, you know, doing Winkleman factor reassessments, I don't know. Do I say it's inappropriately severe and bring it back down to within the parameter and call it good? Do I have that authority? Should I have that authority? Just kind of, again, another wrinkle to shake up the snow globe for everybody.
Yeah, and it's possible that the appellate divisions in the sister services and the Army are all already thinking about these things, and we're going to see these cases bubble up in the next term or so.
Yes.
Okay, here's my last question. This is not one that we have prepped or talked about, but my question for you, subject matter expert in sentencing, what is the distinction, do you think, between plainly unreasonable and whether or not it is correct in law and fact? Is there a distinction? Is there any light between the two?
I think correct in law and fact subsumes plainly unreasonable potentially.
It's wider. It's bigger.
It's bigger.
Yeah.
Yes. I think if something is plainly unreasonable, it is not correct in law, in fact. But I think that the fact that that language is gone
right
means I'm stuck with plainly unreasonable. Mm-hmm. And plainly unreasonable is found in three places. Judge can reject a deal if it's plainly unreasonable, whatever that means. The government can appeal a case if it's plainly unreasonable, whatever that means. I'm not aware of a case that's happened. And then the CCAs now do a review of the sentence if it's plainly unreasonable. I can probably get both defense and government counsel to disagree the levels of plainly unreasonable under 56 and 66, depending on which side of the coin I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be very, very interesting moving forward. I will reiterate, as I've done numerous times on this podcast, statutory language will continue to reign supreme with the current court makeup. It is, if you cannot cite to a statute for why you want them to do something or a case or something, good luck. And so I think that if the statutory language is changed significantly enough you can potentially argue that the whole premise, the whole foundation that some of these cases have been built upon are no longer valid. And we shouldn't be trying to shoehorn a little bit of this, a little bit of that, because it's, you can't separate the reasoning because it's all based upon a system that no longer exists.
Right. And in my unlearned opinion, and when I say unlearned, I mean not having done any case law research or legislative history research, in my mind, correct has a certain connotation to it that plainly unreasonable does not. So I agree with you that I think correct is much wider and gives the appellate courts more wiggle room to reassess a sentence as opposed to plainly unreasonable. I think that is significantly more narrow, and I think that that is going to impact sentence reassessments moving forward.
Well, I'll do you one further. Let me double check my math here.
Listeners, you can't see us, but Major Barrett has all of the MCMs that he listed open in front of him.
That's right. So the only place that you find the language anymore that says correct in fact and law is under factual sufficiency review under 66. Mm-hmm. That language is no longer included in the consideration of sentence, which is now under 66E. So a lot of interesting questions out there.
Major Barrett, to put it in the language of the appellate courts, we have erred. We are at 27 minutes. So we'll go ahead and wrap it up. We've talked a little bit about takeaways and things for the field, but really, again, this was just an exploration and a lot of interesting questions that I think are going to face both the Service, Courts of Criminal Appeal, and CAF in the coming terms. But Major Barrett, do you have anything else before I take us out of here?
Nope. Just thanks for everybody that you do out there. Remember, professionalism, read the statutes, open the book, as I am fond of saying. And if there's something you want to discuss that we've said here, please, by all means, reach out, send me an email, call me.
Thank you, Major Barrett.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.